I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the topsy-turvy midterm elections. According to one pollster, the news for Republicans in Ohio hasn't been this bad since the fall of Richard Nixon. But first, news from Iraq. October is on track to be the third deadliest month for American soldiers there since the war began. 10 U.S. troops were killed yesterday, raising to 69 the number of American troops who have died in October. This comes as Iraqi leaders say they're shaking up the Interior Ministry to try to stop death squads that are destabilizing the country. Los Angeles Times Baghdad Bureau Chief Borzu Daragahi joins us now with his perspective. And Borzu, first of all, what do you think is causing this recent surge in the American death toll?
Well, I think that there's a couple things. One of them, it's Ramadan, the Muslim holy month of fasting and atonement. And for the Sunni extremists that are that make up a large part of the insurgency, it's basically a good time to fight the Americans and fight the what they consider the occupier. Mm-hmm. And I think the other issue is that the U.S. has taken a slightly different tack over the past few weeks, maybe even months. It's doing more patrols. It's out there more often. They're just more of a target instead of being hunkered down in their bases as they were for quite some time.
Well, it's funny because last time we talked, you pointed out some successes with that technique, U.S. troops flooding one area, but when they were there, being sensitive to Iraqi needs, and as you said at the time, perhaps pulling troops out of other areas.
Yeah, but that, even when they did that, even when they would go into certain areas and make them more secure, they were also vulnerable to a lot of attacks. Mm-hmm. Terrible things continue to happen to U.S. soldiers, even when they were taking on a more peacekeeping posture.
Well, you write there's even open warfare north of Baghdad. In and around the Shiite town of Balad, 63 people have been killed there in sectarian fighting. U.S. and Iraqi troops now trying to stem that violence. Have they made inroads?
It appears that today things have calmed down a little bit. There's been a dusk to dawn curfew established in those towns where this open civil warfare has broken out between Shiites and Sunnis. And things have calmed down. Today there was a tribal summit in the nearby city of Tikrit where elders from these various tribes and communities attempted to bring some sort of resolution and bring some calm to this area.
Yeah. Well, yesterday, Interior Ministry officials announced they were replacing the two top police commanders in Iraq. The Interior Ministry said to be infiltrated by rogue death squads. Iraqi officials are saying this is a change in command. This is going to make a difference. What do you say?
Well, I think that the reshuffling is no big deal. It's just sort of a routine matter. As a matter of fact, these two guys who are in charge, who were in charge of two very specialized units that were said to be causing a lot of the trouble in Iraq with regard to being infiltrated by death squads, were at the Dais with the Interior Ministry spokesman as he spoke and said that these guys are getting a promotion, essentially. So it doesn't seem like it's a major change.
Right. Well, this situation is coupled with the upcoming midterm elections in the U.S., and apparently Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's government has been asked by the U.S. to get the militias under control, and he reportedly called President Bush to get assurances that the U.S. would stand behind his government, even if Republicans lose control of one or both houses of Congress in the midterm elections, and perhaps even if he can't get things under control there. Are Iraqis concerned about that? Are they concerned that with a potential change in leadership in the U.S., they might lose support?
Well, just quickly, it was Bush who called Maliki.
Ah.
But also, I would think that you know, I mean, I've talked to a lot of Iraqis about this question, about whether they think that there's going to be a change with the change in Congress. And most sophisticated Iraqis, and they're closely watching this, most politicians are closely watching what's happening in Washington. They say that America is a country of institutions. Those institutions go on a certain course, and it's not going to matter which direction the Congress goes. America's going to essentially stay on the same course. America can't essentially afford to lose in Iraq, so that they are not too worried about it.
Borzu Daragahi, Los Angeles Times Baghdad bureau chief, speaking to us from Baghdad. Borzu, thanks as always.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Election Day here in the U.S. is less than 3 weeks away, so we thought we'd spend a few minutes today digging into some specific races as the campaign for control of Congress heads into the home stretch. President Bush, once such an asset for the party, isn't being asked to make many appearances. In fact, last week, Saturday Night Live made much of that in a skit that placed the president at some county controller's debate. Well, today, he's in North Carolina raising money, but lately, First Lady Laura Bush has been making more campaign appearances than her husband. And the GOP also seems to be pulling money out of races where the candidates are trailing. So will the Democrats take advantage of these trends and pull off a big win next month? Or, as their critics say, do Democrats still have no message? Well, we have two guests who are going to try to help us answer that question as we look at Ohio and Missouri. First, we got Bob Benenson, editor of the Congressional Quarterly website, CQPolitics.com. Bob, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
We're also joined by Jonathan Riskin, Washington Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome to you as well, Jonathan.
Great to be here.
And I want to start with Bob. And Bob, I've got your website up on my computer here. And you've got that great map where you shift all the time from red to blue. And you've also got the Balance of Power scorecard. Anyone can check this in at CQPolitics.com.
Yeah.
First of all, what are you showing?
Well, what we're showing is a continued trend in the favor of the Democrats. And this has been going on all year. We've, as you suggest, we've changed our ratings on dozens of races over the course of the year, and about 95 to 98% of them have been in favor of the Democrats. We knew this was going to be a tough year for the Republicans from the start.
Why? Why is that?
Because President Bush's approval ratings had already dropped very significantly by the end of last year, the beginning of this year. A public approval for Congress was, spiraling kind of out of control. Of course, you know, the problems in Iraq and the fact that it looks more and more like an inextricable problem for the United States is the elephant in the living room. I mean, it's the biggest issue that overshadows the entire campaign.
And yet, having said that, I just want to jump in for a second.
Yeah.
I'm looking at your Balance of Power scorecard.
Yeah.
And as you note, I'm on the House map page.
Right.
218 seats are needed for a majority. And as you note, the states leaning Democrat are 209, and the seats rather leaning Democrat 209, and the seats leaning Republican 209.
Exactly. But to put that in perspective, just within maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, the Republicans were still over 218 in that projection. Mm. But and just to clarify on that projection, we regard at this point only 164 Republican seats as safe. And interestingly, we regarded 183 Democratic seats as safe. There are still about 70 Republican seats in play. That is an enormously larger number than we've seen in recent years, where competitive races for the House were really constricted to maybe two or three dozen. So what all these problems that the Republicans face nationally has done is put a lot of seats in the competition that we just haven't seen lately. A lot of those, 19 of those races, we still have rated as leans Republican. By our definition, leans means it's a highly competitive race and that one party may have a leg up in some areas, a popular incumbent, money advantage, political demographics in the district, but it doesn't mean that that the other party can't win.
Well, in fact, you apparently have some news today for Jonathan Riskin, who's again with
yes.
the Columbus Dispatch, news about Ohio. So fill Jonathan in on that.
Just yesterday, we changed four ratings of races in Ohio, changing the Senate race where Mike DeWine is facing a serious challenge from Democratic Representative Sherrod Brown. We changed that to leans Democratic, and that makes it the third Senate race that we have rated at where the Republican incumbent is the underdog, and there's still several others where there that are toss-ups where Republican incumbents are in trouble. We also changed the governor's race to Democrat-favored from leans Democratic, and two races that shouldn't even be on the board. In a normal election year, there's no way that these would be difficult races for the Republicans. In the 2nd District and the 12th District, both typically Republican strongholds, we moved the 2nd District to leans Republican and the 12th District to Republican favored.
Jonathan, what is going on here? First of all, I want to ask you about this new polling, because there are reports that Republicans are pulling their money out of the race between Republican incumbent Mike DeWine and Democratic Congressman Sherrod Brown. But others are saying they are because they're seeing these polling results and they say they can't win there. What are you seeing?
The Republicans are vehemently denying a report that first surfaced in the New York Times that they're quote-unquote pulling out of the Ohio race, pulling all their national money out of DeWine's race. They say they just went on with an anti-attack ad against Sherrod Brown, the Democratic Senate candidate, yesterday, and they're going to spend $700,000. However, our sources are telling us that a lot of Republicans have concluded that they're in a really tough situation in that race. Ohio is an extremely bad climate for Republicans this year. The Republicans themselves will tell you that. And
but how unusual is that, by the way?
Well, it's unusual over the past 15 years. The Republicans have held every statewide non-judicial office since 1990. They've had a House majority for a number of years as well. They have two Republican senators. They basically controlled the entire apparatus of state government and held the majority in the federal delegations. So and of course, President Bush famously won Ohio in 2000 and 2004, although some Democrats will still,
debate
that.
What do you think is going on here? I mean, Bob mentioned the war in Iraq being overriding in many cases, but what else is going on in Ohio?
I think there's a certain weariness that builds up with any party being in control for so long, and that's exacerbated greatly by state house scandals surrounding the governor, Bob Taft, who's had some ethics problems. And there's a famous case now known as Coingate, where a Republican fundraiser and bigwig Tom Noe is on trial right now, accused of basically embezzling $50 million in a rare coin investment from the Bureau of Workers' Compensation. He's also been in trouble for fundraising practices. So all of this, and now the Mark Foley scandal, famously, and the Florida congressman in trouble with his contacts with inappropriate contacts, of course, with House pages, I think is just feeding a very difficult climate for Republicans in Ohio. And of course, if Republicans are eyeing the DeWine race nervously and perhaps scaling back their national commitment, if they are, the polling numbers they may have been looking at surfaced public yesterday in three polls. One poll, the Ohio poll out of University of Cincinnati, had DeWine losing by 7 points. The second poll by Quinnipiac had DeWine trailing Sherrod Brown by 12 points. And then late in the day, the New York Times CBS poll released the worst news for DeWine, saying that he was actually down, in their estimation, 14 points. So if you take the average of those polls, none of it is good news for Mike DeWine. And the last point I would make is that a lot of Republicans are depressed because with just under 3 weeks left to the election, they believe that at this point, a lot of vulnerable Republicans are below 50%. And with undecided theoretically going in the end to Democrats this year, they're not sure how a number of Republicans, including DeWine, are going to pull it out.
That's Jonathan Riskin, Washington Bureau Chief for the Columbus Dispatch. And speaking of corruption, you didn't even mention Republican Congressman Bob Ney, who just pleaded guilty to federal corruption charges in the Jack Abramoff scandal. So a lot going on in Ohio. We've also been talking to Bob Benenson, editor of CQPolitics.com. By the way, again, you can get to his map and all his stuff at here-now.org. We'll link you. When we come back, where is the Republican Evangelical Christian Republican base in Ohio? You may be surprised. And we'll take a look at another key Senate race in Missouri. And a quick reminder here, also ahead today, the new head of the Episcopal Church in America, she says just call her Bishop Catherine. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, back with Jonathan Riskin, Washington Bureau Chief of the Columbus, Ohio Dispatch, and Bob Benenson, editor of CQPolitics.com. Now, if the Republicans are giving up the Ohio Senate seat, as some are saying, they're working hard to keep Republican Jim Talent's Senate seat in Missouri. In that race, a TV spot for the Democratic candidate, Missouri State Auditor Claire McCaskill, has generated some controversy. She appears with an Iraq War vet. Let's listen.
I returned from Iraq with a busted ankle and post-traumatic stress. It was 6 months before I could see a doctor. We joined up thinking we were promised these rights, these benefits, and they broke that promise. Politicians like Jim Talent don't have to wait 6 months for a doctor's appointment.
Well, now, Republicans are questioning whether that Iraq vet really did have to wait for health care. But meantime, Jim Talent has an ad as well, and it has more of the Republican Party line. Let's listen.
Of all the jobs the government has, the most important is keeping us safe. We have to stop terrorists before they strike. We have to know who they are, where they are, and what they're doing. Things like tracking Al-Qaeda phone calls, monitoring their finances, have helped save the lives of Americans.
Bob Benison, CQPolitics.com. It sounds as if Jim Talon is going with the Republican Party line, you know, I'll make you safer. The Democrats pulling a voice in from Iraq, and it's caused a little controversy. How's that all playing out?
It's playing out in one of the closest races in the country. The little background on Missouri. Missouri is a lot like Ohio in that it's a quintessential, it has a history of being a quintessential swing state or a bellwether state that in recent years, because they have enough of a conservative base, has been trending pretty much the Republicans. However, the Democrats say, no, it really is a swing state. We can win here. So they've come back fighting hard against Jim Talon, who won his Senate seat in a special election in 2002 by just one percentage point. And they think he's highly vulnerable. Claire McCaskill, the Democrat who's running against him, ran for governor and only lost by 3 points in 2004, even as President Bush was winning the state by 7 points. So that's the format within which they're running. The polls that we see constantly now, national polls, say that if there's any issue on which the public gives the Republicans a benefit of doubt, it's terrorism. But even that is waning.
Well, in fact, I want to, before we move back to Jonathan Riskin, I want to just take a look. I'm on your Senate page on the website. Again, you got all the colors on the states.
Yep.
And your balance of power scorecard, you have leans Democrat 47 seats, leans Republican 49, no clear favorite 4. But again, put that in context for us. How has that changed over the last few weeks?
It's changed dramatically. The Republicans were as high as 54 seats in the projection. Again,
51 is needed for a majority there.
Well, yeah, 51 is needed for a majority by the Democrats. 50 is needed as a majority by the Republicans mm-hmm. because the Vice President of the United States cast the tie-breaking vote, right. including on organizing the Senate. So the Democrats have a much higher hill to climb here, and they're playing on mostly what was just 2 years ago Republican turf. There are only two seats that the Democrats have a real opportunity to take over in Pennsylvania and Rhode Island that voted for John Kerry for president last time. So in order to pull this off and get a 6-seat net gain, they have to win in places like Ohio and Missouri and Tennessee and Montana and Arizona and Virginia in order to get the numbers that they need. However, they have made serious progress over the last few weeks. You know, the red state phenomenon I just mentioned is one thing. There are a lot of structural advantages that the Republicans brought into this campaign, and some of them, you know, may still pull out some of their candidates. They have a huge voter turnout machine that you know is very detailed and very micro targeted on individual Republican voters who they will be bombarding with messages and efforts to get them to go to the polls, even if they have some regrets about the Republican
Party. Well, I want to ask Jonathan Riskin about that, because that's what people are saying, that even though the Democrats may be pulling ahead in some of the opinion polls because of issues like corruption or the war in Iraq, the Republicans have the better get out the vote machine and they have more money. What are you seeing in Ohio?
What I'm hearing is that Republicans are worried that Democrats can't wait to vote and that Republicans aren't particularly excited about voting.
Jonathan Riskin, and then I want to ask you as well, Bob, what are you hearing from specifically evangelical Christian voters? We have this new poll from the New York Times, CBS. It shows support for President Bush in Ohio in particular slipping among white evangelicals almost precipitously. 76% voted for the president in 2004. This poll shows just 49% approve of him now. What are you hearing there, Jonathan first, then Bob?
Well, there was some information along those lines in the recent Quinnipiac survey, I believe. DeWine, in that survey, that was the one that came out yesterday that had DeWine down by 12 points, and his advantage among white evangelical Christians dropped from 36 points to 20 points.
Bob Benenson, what are you seeing nationwide?
Well, you know, what we're seeing is, you know, this is not just an overnight phenomenon. The Democrats, after 2004, when, you know, the fact that the Republicans were able to mobilize such a strong turnout amongst the evangelical Christians may not have been the decisive factor, but it was an important factor in President Bush winning re-election. They decided to fight back, and so did a lot of liberal evangelical Christians. They try to make the case, and they've been campaigning across the country to say, it's not all just about these social issues. It's not just about abortion. It's not just about gay rights or gay marriage. It's also about, you know, giving a hand up to the poor, you know, loving your neighbor, you know, doing all the other things that in dealing with needy people and people who, you know, have handicaps. that they see as
being a Christian.
Being Christian.
Jonathan Riskin, I'm going to let you be the last word because we're focusing on Ohio today, and I just wonder, with everything you've been talking about, the corruption, the concern about the Foley scandal and the war in Iraq and the economy in Ohio, just briefly, what do you think? Is this just a scare for the Republicans, or do you think the state's going to tip?
Unless things shift back for the Republicans over the next couple weeks, I think they're headed for a bad election day.
Oh, well, we seem to have lost our line there. That was Jonathan Riskin, Washington Bureau Chief of the Columbus, Ohio Dispatch. We were also speaking with Bob Bennison, editor of CQPolitics.com. I tell you what, it's still 20 days till Election Day, so we'll be sure to have them back, giving us so much insight into races across the country. And you stay right there. We were speaking about religion in America, and coming up, we're going to meet the new head of the Episcopal Church in America, facing a huge debate in her church over issues such as homosexual marriages. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Bishop Katharine Jefferts Schori, a former oceanographer and a pilot, is slated to become the first woman to head the Episcopal Church of America. That will happen on November 1st. She's inheriting a church divided over the ordination of homosexuals and the blessing of same-sex unions. Her own election has precipitated a double crisis over the role of women. In the American church, some Episcopal dioceses have asked to leave because they don't accept a woman as a leader. And international Episcopal churches have also said they cannot accept a woman as head of a national church. For her part, Bishop Katharine has been quoted as saying that if her opponents leave the table, she will rise to follow them to continue the dialogue. Well, Bishop Jefferts Schori joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
And boy, as I read some of the recent history of the church, it does sound like a somewhat tough road to hoe that you're entering.
Well, I think all ages have their challenges. This is simply ours.
Yeah. Well, when you were elected primate, that is, head of the U.S. Episcopal Church, you were quoted as saying, "We're not here to argue about matters of sexuality. We're here to build a holy community." But as you know, there are people arguing about sexuality. What are you going to do to heal that?
Well, we're going to keep conversing. We're going to continue to ask people to meet gay and lesbian Christians and to begin to see some of the fruits of their ministry. We're going to continue to wrestle with these issues. They are the issues of our day. The issues of, you know, recent generations have been about the place of women in the church and the place of African Americans in the church and the place of immigrants in the church. And I simply see this as our current growth into a larger communion.
Because why? Why do you believe so firmly that that's the right direction for the church?
Well, as a scientist and as a person of faith, I understand that sexual orientation is a given for almost all people. It's not a matter of choice. And in that case, if this is how people are created, then our job as a community of faith is to assist people in finding holy ways of living in relationship. And that's what we're about.
What do you say to your congruents who might say, "Well, I also, you know, understand that there are people who might be gay or lesbian, but I just don't want them as my bishop, as Gene Robinson is now in New Hampshire, or, you know, to be married in the church that I also attend." What do you say to them?
Well, it's a challenge, but I think God calls us into challenging situations. I think that's how we grow. The early church dealt with it. The place of Gentiles in the church, did new Gentile converts have to be circumcised? Did they have to live by Jewish dietary laws, or could they be welcomed as they were? There will be another group after gay and lesbian Christians. I don't know who it will be, but there will be another one, because that's who we are as human beings.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you were a scientist. I remember recently I was on a little field trip with A.O. Wilson, the scientist. And,
oh, my.
And he calls himself a secular humanist, and he just says, mm-hmm. as a scientist, he just has looked and looked and looked. I mean, he said, "I'd love to be the one to prove there was a God. Wouldn't that be great? Mm-hmm. You know, that'd be the greatest scientific discovery, but I can't see the proof." So, how about you as a scientist, and scientists, you know, want to see proof of something? How are you then also a person of faith?
I came back. I was raised, as, you know, in the church, and I came back to the church as an adult when I was in graduate school and began to read the physicists who talked about mystery, Heisenberg and Bohr and Einstein. Here were people who were going down the same kinds of roads that I had gone down, saying, no, there's something innately mysterious about creation, something beyond what we can deal with in scientific terms. Hard science asks questions about how and what, and faith traditions ask questions of meaning. What does it mean to be a human being in this world? How can I live a life that is good?
Time magazine asked you an interesting question, we thought. Is belief in Jesus the only way to get to heaven? And your answer, equally interesting, you said, we who practice the Christian tradition understand him as our vehicle to the divine, but for us to assume that God could not act in other ways is, I think, to put God in an awfully small box. And I read that and I said, what are you, a Unitarian? what are, you know, that is another concern for people, because they say Scripture says that Jesus said that he was the light and the way and the only way to God the Father.
Christians understand that Jesus is the route to God. That is not to say that Muslims or Sikhs or Jains come to God in a radically different way. They come to God through human experience, through human experience of the divine. Christians talk about that in terms of Jesus.
So you're saying there are other ways to God?
Human communities have always searched for relationship with that which is beyond them, with the ultimate, with the divine. For Christians, we say that our route to God is through Jesus. That doesn't mean that a Hindu doesn't experience God except through Jesus. It says that Hindus and other people of other faith traditions approach God through their own cultural contexts. They relate to God. They experience God in human relationships as well as ones that transcend human relationships. And Christians would say those are our experiences of Jesus, of God through the experience of Jesus.
It sounds like you're saying it's sort of a parallel reality, but in another culture and language.
I think that's accurate. I think that's accurate.
Bishop Catherine, you have a fascinating life story. Your dad was a physicist. Mom had a degree in literature, became a biologist. You, as we said, were an oceanographer, grew up in Seattle. You have a daughter who's a second lieutenant and a pilot in the Air Force. By the way, is she serving?
She's serving stateside, and she's now a first lieutenant.
How about you? Do you still pilot a plane?
I do. I flew from Reno to Henderson yesterday.
What kind of plane do you fly?
Cessna 172.
Yeah. And what does that do for you, besides get you from A to B?
that's the easy part. It's, for me, an encounter with the vastness of creation and the Creator. It's a reminder that I am a very small piece of it, that I am constrained by human limits. And it gives me a very different perspective on the world.
Bishop Catherine Jefford Shorey, slated to become the head of the Episcopal Church of America on November 1st. Bishop Catherine, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, just ahead, we have Tribute Times 3, Jazz Genuflections 2, Junior Walker and Cannonball Adderley, and a tribute from Gladys Knight. You're listening to Here and Now. quick question. Can you tell the difference between a Sunni and Shiites, the two Islamic factions fighting it out in Iraq? Well, hopefully, if you've been listening to this program, you can. I mean, we've practically had PowerPoint presentations on this topic, but we know also that it can be confusing for the average busy American. Well, Congressional Quarterly National Security Editor Jeff Stein thinks it shouldn't be confusing for people involved in counterterrorism. He posed that very question, can you tell the difference between a Sunni and a Shiite, to intelligence and law enforcement officials and lawmakers on Capitol Hill. He wrote about what he found in an op-ed piece in the New York Times. He joins us now. And Jeff, we know that on a religious level, the Sunnis and Shiites differ over who succeeded the Prophet Muhammad. But can you remind us which group has a majority in which area of the region?
The Shiites are the majority in Iraq and a vast majority in Iran. The Sunnis are the vast majority in Saudi Arabia, although they have an important Shiite minority in the east, in the north. The Hezbollah is a creature of Iran, and therefore it is a Shia. Hamas is Sunni.
So with that in mind, you do your own informal poll, and this is in the course of doing interviews for your job. Give us some examples. You spoke to Willie Hulon. He's the chief of the FBI's National Security Branch, and as you point out, a distinguished agent who sits up nights worrying about Al-Qaeda so that we can all safely sleep. Mm-hmm. So you have respect for him, but what did he tell you when you asked him that question?
Well, he just fumbled with an answer. Like, the basics go back to their beliefs and who they were following and the conflicts between the Sunnis and the Shia and the differences in who they were following. I said, okay, which is which? Iran, for example, Sunni or Shiite? And he thought for a second, and he couldn't answer that. And I said, Iran and Hezbollah. I said, who are they? And he said, Sunni. I said, wrong. We both sort of chuckled, and he said, well, you caught me at a wrong time. I was thinking about something else. And I said, okay, well, Al-Qaeda. Which are they? And he said, Sunni. So he got that right.
Did you get the idea that he was guessing?
Yeah.
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 Well,
but, you know, this was a big advance because FBI officials famously in videotaped depositions the year before hadn't been able to answer any basic questions about Sunni and Shia. And then they asserted very strongly that it wasn't important to know the difference between them. It was important to be a good manager.
Well, you also went to other members of Congress with this current question, including Virginia Republican Joanne Davis. She heads the House Subcommittee on Intelligence that oversees the CIA. What was her response? Did she know?
No, she was totally flummoxed by the question. She said, do I know? You know, I should know, she said, because I'm not just on the Intelligence Committee. I'm on International Relations and Armed Services. So I asked her, well, which one is which? She said, Al-Qaeda is the one that's the most radical. So I think they're Sunni. I may be wrong, but I think that's right.
She was right in, as you said, sort of like guessing that. But, you know, for people, Jeff, who would say that this is sort of a gotcha question, an Islamic Trivial Pursuit, it's not fair, perhaps, what do you say?
If a general manager of the Red Sox was asked, do you know the difference between a bunt and a steal? And he couldn't answer the question, I'd say that person is not qualified.
Or, as you point out, if the British government was asked the difference between a Catholic and a Protestant.
Yeah, I think that's a rough approximation. If you were in charge of counterterrorism, again, I'm asking counterterrorism intelligence officials. I'm not asking even ordinary congressmen on the Agriculture Committee or something else, although it would be nice, considering we're at war in Iraq and there's a civil war developing between Sunnis and Shia, it'd be nice to know, you know, what's the logo on their helmet? What's the name on the back of their uniform?
What are readers saying to you?
This is the biggest response to a piece I've ever gotten in 30 years of journalism. And a lot of the mid-level or in-the-trenches officials I talked to were appalled at the lack of knowledge on the behalf of their own superiors. So it's just endemic that we don't know the difference, and I think it's touched a nerve upon readers. I mean, when you have a piece in the New York Times, it goes all over the world. Of course, you have a huge audience there. But I've gotten about 100 emails. It turns out to be the most emailed piece at the paper and the most blogged, whatever that means. I'm an old print guy, so I'm not sure what this means. But it's touched a nerve, I think, among readers. And if I would guess, it would be that because it relates to the lack of intelligence about Iraq before the war and doing badly in Iraq.
And apparently even now.
That's right.
Jeff Stein, National Security Editor at Congressional Quarterly. His op-ed piece, Can You Tell a Sunni from a Shiite, was in the New York Times yesterday. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The dynamic sound of tenor saxophonist, vocalist, songwriter Junior Walker, who had a dozen top 40 pop hits from the mid-1960s to the early 70s, including Pucker Up, Buttercup, What Does It Take to Win Your Love for Me, and of course this one, Shotgun, which topped the R&B chart in 1965 as well. Here now, jazz aficionado James Isaacs joins us now to talk about a brand new tribute album to Junior Walker and the All-Stars from jazz clarinetist, saxophonist, and composer Don Byron. The CD is called Do the Boomerang, the Music of Junior Walker. It's one of three tribute albums to which James wants to pay tribute. Welcome, James.
Hello again, Robin.
So I'm thinking Junior Walker, you know, pop and R&B, and jazz musician Don Byron paying tribute to him. Is that unusual?
Well, let me think about that. I would say that given Don Byron's history, it's not so unusual because Don Byron is a musical omnivore. He's a guy who's previously recorded tunes by everyone ranging from the Borscht Belt comedian and clarinetist and singer-songwriter Mickey Katz to Ornette Coleman, and from Tchaikovsky to Henry Mancini, from Raymond Scott to Miles Davis. And, of course, he's written a lot of his own challenging music, much of it displaying his irreverent senses of wit and humor. But today he applies his senses of wit and humor to Junior Walker's music.
And that music has been primarily, you know, we think of it as dance music.
True.
So where does jazz improvisation come in with that kind of music?
Robin, the Junior Walker oeuvre is not the
there
most...
there is such a thing.
It's not the most harmonically adventuresome. What he played was essentially the blues for dancing, and these records highlighted Junior Walker's raspy vocals and his honking and shouting tenor saxophone. And yes, Junior Walker's singles were terrific. They are terrific dance records, and that's how the Don Byron Band handles the material. They stretch out more than Junior Walker and the All-Stars, and I'd say that they're more into a fusion of jazz, rock, and soul, especially the guitar player David Gilmour. But the groove prevails throughout. The groove is the thing. I should also point out that Don Byron sounds nothing like Junior Walker as a saxophonist. Where Junior Walker is rough-edged and growling, Don Byron is cool, kind of like, oh, Lester Young meets Eddie Harris.
It's Don Byron's version of Shotgun. I know you want to recommend a new CD by one of the outstanding singers of the 60s and beyond, Ms. Gladys Knight.
In this case, Robin, a pipless Gladys Knight. In the 60s, Gladys Knight and Junior Walker both recorded for the Soul record label, and that was a Motown subsidiary. Now Gladys Knight honors some of the great female singers who came before her and directly influenced her. The new CD for Verve is called Before Me, and the superlative vocalists honored by Gladys Knight include the Big Four of jazz singing, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, and Dinah Washington, plus the once and future queen of gospel, Mahalia Jackson, and the forever glamorous Lena Horne. The tune that we're hearing now, This Bitter Earth, was a Dinah Washington signature.
But while a voice within me cries, someone may answer my call, and this bitter earth may not be so bitter after all.
Oh, and it reminds us, Gladys Knight can sing. And does this mean, since it's her tribute to other women, is it all standards?
12 very well-known standards, and if I have any small complaint about this disc, it's that the repertoire is more than a little bit familiar, overly familiar. I would say what makes this album so compelling and so listenable is that Gladys Knight approaches her material like the great gospel-trained soul ballad singer she is. Plus, the arrangements here by bassist John Clayton or pianist Billy Childs are beautifully crafted throughout. The accompaniments are by the Clayton Hamilton Jazz Orchestra, sometimes augmented by strings, and they serve the singer so very well.
And let's listen to some more. What have you got?
Well, it's the Gershwin song, Someone to Watch Over Me. We're near the conclusion of the piece, and Gladys Knight, with the orchestra arranged by Billy Childs, really brings it home. Listen how, toward the end of this excerpt, Knight's voice almost becomes one of the strings.
Someone to watch over me.
Ooh, that's just beautiful.
Yes.
Well, again, Gladys Knight's new album, Before Me. And we make a note of that as well. Final selection for today, James Isaacs.
Well, Robin, we're back on the instrumental side, and we turn to straight-ahead jazz from a new CD on the Savant label by drummer Lewis Hayes and the Cannonball Adderley Legacy Band. The album's title is Maximum Firepower, and it's an homage to the late alto and soprano saxophonist and composer Julian Cannonball Adderley, in whose quintet and sextet Hayes was the drummer.
When was that?
1959 to 1965. Lewis Hayes was 22 years old when he joined Adderley back in 59.
And how would you define Cannonball Adderley's music?
Robin, I'm going to use a term that Miles Davis was fond of using, social music. More accurately, Cannonball Adderley's music was an amalgam of bebop, the blues, and gospel, and this was called soul jazz. This was music that didn't scare people away because they thought it was too complicated. You know, a lot of people thought bebop at the time was too complicated or too cool, like West Coast jazz.
Well, they didn't say that about Cannonball.
No, they didn't. Cannonball's approach was direct, melodic, warm, and always swinging. The tune we're going to hear is a Cannonball Adderley original called Sack o' Woe. Lewis Hayes, not a flashy drummer, always a tasteful one, though, and he knows exactly how to play in both sides. And the alto saxophone solo we're going to hear is by Vincent Herring, and he's got a nice, fat, meaty sound like Cannonball, but he doesn't really sound like him.
Sack o' Woe from Lewis Hayes' new tribute CD to Cannonball Adderley. That CD is called Maximum Firepower, one of three tribute CDs that James Isaacs is paying tribute to today. We'll have a list of all the original music of the three artists and three new CDs at our website here-now.org. So James will go out on Sack o' Woe, but it's not as bad as it sounds,
no,
right?
It's very joyful music despite that title.
Which is what all the tributes you've brought are. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. I'll see you soon.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.